You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com. Hello, everybody. This is Nadira Jamal, the Belly Dance Geek, and welcome to episode 63 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, things like moves, combos, choreographies, there are a lot of resources out there. But if you want help with the why and the how, musicality, business, culture, composition, training, teacher training, all of those things are harder to find. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic, and we always have time for question and answer so that you can geek out too. And if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest tonight is Farha. Farha means joy in Arabic, and she teaches and performs in the New York area in order to share the joy of this dance with anyone who needs a little more sparkle in their lives. And don't we all? Farha is also inspired by her students as they learn to control their bodies and gain new voices in her classes. She's always seeking ways to expand her knowledge and skill with a focus on the Egyptian styles. She travels whenever possible for workshops with some of the best teachers available. You can check her out at Farha Belly Dance, and that name is spelled F-A-R-H-A. You can also find her in her previous appearance on the Clubhouse in episode 53, Mapping Your Dance Journey. So welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. So everybody, today Farha is going to talk about cross-training within the Middle Eastern dance family. But before we do that, Farha, I would love to hear your origin story. So can you tell us about how you got started in belly dance and also how you got interested in cross-training?
Yeah. So first I want to apologize if I'm a little like coughy and fighting a little bit of a chest cold. So I started, kind of the short version is that a friend of mine got a DVD and then I got hooked. And so it was, the DVD was Dancing the Sacred Shapes with the Goddess Dancing. And
Boston shout out.
Yep. At the time, though, I didn't really know, like, one style from the next, and I watched a lot of Rachel Bryce, and I thought that that DVD was a tribal style DVD, and I thought that that's the only style that I was going to be interested in, and so I was in undergrad out in Fredonia, New York, and the only class that was around was kind of a, you know, a generic belly dance. At the time, we called it just cabaret style. You can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes. And so I was like, oh, I really like this too. So when I graduated and I moved back to Syracuse, I thought, okay, well, I'll take like a class in each and you know, see how it goes. And so I was taking a class in kind of they weren't specifically doing fat chance format, but kind of generally ATS, ITS style. And then I was also taking a class with the woman who ended up being my kind of long-term teacher when I was starting out, Hannah, who does AMCAB and mostly AMCAB, and she has a heavy Turkish influence in her style. But I was lucky to be in her classes because she would present us with different techniques and different theories and guidelines and, you know, different things that would, you know, help us with our, I'm blanking on the word right now, but then different concepts. And then she would have us, you know, kind of apply them and improvise on our own. And as I was in her class, I had started kind of watching more like vintage and classic Egyptian clips on YouTube, like Fifi and Soher and Mona, and also like Sami and Sahaya and Naima Akef. And so I was in class, and that was kind of starting to come out. And she looked at me and she was like, "You're doing Egyptian. Where are you getting this from?" And that kind of started me off on that trajectory.
All right. So, you know, our talk for today is about cross-training within the Middle Eastern dance family. And so when we're talking about that umbrella, or when we talk about different styles of belly dance, what do we actually mean?
I'm generally talking about any different belly dance style, and also different Middle Eastern dance styles. There's a lot of different belly dance styles, and then there's also a lot of Middle Eastern dances that aren't belly dance, like Nubian and Saidi and Romani and Debki and Shtat and I can't think of the name for the Saudi one with the hair.
Khaliji.
Yes, Khaliji, but with that specific one. Sobel Nasser, I think. And Kaulia dance from Iraq, and all of these things that are Middle Eastern dances, but that aren't really belly dance. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I think of it almost like a language, like belly dance is one language, but there's a lot of different dialects within that. If that makes sense.
It does. So, you know, it sounds like you've just cited a whole bunch of folkloric styles, but even within Oriental, we tend to break those up into styles. So for folks who may not have thought about this much, do you want to mention some examples?
So I'm not going to talk too much about Greek or Iraqi belly dance, just because I don't have enough information to speak knowledgeably about them. But, you know, there's belly dance styles there. And actually with Iraqi dance, with Iraqi belly dance, with Iraqi Rakhshirki, there's some of the stars that were big stars in Lebanon, and I want to say the 80s had come from Iraq. And so this is there as well. I usually break it into, so there's Golden Era Egyptian, which I wish I could call Silver Screen, but it's not my dance, so I don't get to name it. And that would generally be like the 30s, 40s, and 50s Egyptian cinema kind of style, a little bit of the 60s. And then what I'm going to call classical style Egyptian, so that's like later part of the 60s, 70s, 80s, a little bit into the 90s, depending on which dancer you're talking about. And then modern Egyptian, kind of being like everything that was really influenced by like Dina forward. And then there's several different eras within Turkish dance as well. Me not having as clear a focus in Turkey, I usually group them into kind of vintage and modern, so kind of like a pre and post Ebo show, when there was kind of a break in the lineage of who the Turkish dancers were and who was teaching who. excuse me. And then with Lebanese style, you have a style that, like, nowadays you could kind of see represented in Suhadib, which was very similar to that golden era black and white cinema Egyptian style, but, you know, still with a little bit of a Lebanese flavor. But at that time, those styles were very similar. And, you know, for example, Vidya Masabni was from the Levant. And they both have that kind of Awalim, you know, family of entertainers kind of background. And then Nadia Jamal, who actually started off, she was an Egyptian woman, and she made most of her career in Lebanon, and she experimented a lot with jazz fusion, and between that and the Civil War, the Lebanese style kind of morphed and split apart from the Egyptian. And then over in the U.S., starting from all of the, you know, the immigrant nightclubs and you know, there's been lots of Clubhouse talks about more specifics within this. You have what you can call AMCAB or American Cabaret, but I don't usually like saying cabaret because it's a word that's not, it's a word that means very different things depending on where you are. But I'll still say it, the abbreviation AMCAB. I've also heard it called Vintage American or American Restaurant or different things like Vintage Oriental and different things like that. And then kind of in the 80s or thereabouts, there started to be a shift of American dancers getting tapes and being able to take flights over. And so the shift in, like, the major influence in the AMCAB style, and so speaking very generally, obviously there's, you know, individual differences from dancer to dancer, and there's regional differences, and there's differences depending on what club you're employed at and all of these things. But in general, the shift went from being more Turkish influenced to more Egyptian influenced. So from like the 90s on, you have more Egyptian influence, and you also have things like the Belly Dance Superstars and just an absolute explosion of different props that you can use. And so I also include in the Belly Dance umbrella fusion styles. So if we're using this language metaphor, all of these different styles that I've just listed would be like, you know, dialects of Arabic. You know, like you have Saudi dialect, and you have Egyptian dialect, and you have Levantine dialect, and you have Maghrebi dialect. And then when you get to like the fusion styles, it's sort of like now you're speaking Frarabic, French and Arabic, instead of a specific Arabic dialect. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So to, you know, those are great examples, but to kind of like summarize all of that, one thing I think I want to drive home is that when we talk about style, we're not just talking about what country something comes from. We're talking both about its kind of like regional community-based influences, where it falls in time, and then also whether it's Oriental folklore or fusion. So it's almost like a matrix.
Yeah. And I actually... And like to use the language metaphor again, you can't talk about a style without talking about a time period. So like think of, you know, the kind of slang that people used in the 50s and the kind of slang that people use now is completely different.
Get on the trolley.
Yeah, right on, daddy-o. and I also tend to think of... I think we like to make history into sort of discrete timelines, discrete like integers, not discrete like being quiet about something. And it's not. I tend to think of it more, at least when it comes to belly dance history, more like several different streams that are kind of running along parallel to each other. And sometimes those streams are going to merge, like when the Ottoman Empire expanded, those streams are going to merge, and then they're going to split back apart. And so where you might have one stream that's running along and it's got red water in it, and another stream running along and it's got blue water in it, and then the Ottoman Empire expands and they come together, and now you have a purple stream. So... all of these different kind of like little particles of water that make up the different things that make a style, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little later. They're mixing back and forth through all of these different styles and constantly changing over time. Like you know, naturalists will say, you know, you can never visit the same river twice. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about dance as an art form is it's always different every time.
All right. Well, that leads me to my next question, which is essentially what you said, which is what makes a style a style?
So kind of briefly, I guess, on the technique side, you know, there's going to be differences in muscle use and posture, the use of space, musicality and timing and your movement choices, but also like how you relate to the audience, kind of the values and the goals of your dance. That varies from style to style, the type of music you're going to use, and of course how you're going to relate to it. One thing that's really interesting between like Egyptian and Turkish style, one of the things that people like notice a lot is that Egyptian dancers don't use finger cymbals as much. They do still use them. It is a myth that they don't use them at all. They usually save them for melody portions of a set, but they do still use them. Whereas Turkish dancers tend to use finger cymbals, at least in the vintage style, much more consistently throughout the show. And so one of the things that helps to kind of explain this, and it also shows up in the shift of American dancers using them a lot in AMCAB versus much less now. In Turkey, a venue, this is what I've been told, at least from dancers who, you know, specialize in Turkish, is that the venue will hire a band and the venue will hire a dancer. And so, whereas in Egypt, a dancer is hired and then the dancer hires her band. So the band is working for you, and you know, if the band's working for you, they're going to work a little harder to like to give you a good show. Whereas if you and the band are both hired by the venue, sometimes, you know, depending on the personalities involved, you might need to have a little kind of foot in the door to control what's going on with the music. And your finger cymbals can be that foot in the door to be like, I need you to slow this down. Or, okay, the audience is falling asleep. Let's pick it up. I know you're really into this talk scene, but come on, they're falling asleep in their hammocks. Let's go. And in the US, there are a lot of things that contributed to like the decline of finger cymbal playing here, but one of them is that we're dancing to recorded music. You don't need to have that foot in the door with the band as much as you used to. Also, you know, things like technology, things like politics, things like economics are going to influence why a style looks the way it does.
Now, you talked about differing values and goals. Can you break that down a little bit more for us?
Yeah, I think so. You even within like the gig scene in the US, just because we have so much diversity, you can think of, are you being hired for Uncle Bob's 50th birthday, where your job is to show up and embarrass him and give everyone some good pictures and then get out of the way so they can get on with the party before they get bored? Or are you being hired by an Egyptian couple's grandma who's like, you can't have a wedding without a belly dancer, and wants you to do like a traditional bridal procession? Or are you being hired to dance at an arts festival, where you might be doing belly dance, or you might even be doing a folkloric style, depending on what they're looking for? So those are all going to influence, those are going to kind of determine the goals of your performance, and you know what the audience is expecting from you is going to change in all of those situations, and that's going to influence how you dance. And when that is, you know, consistent over, you know, long enough kind of over your career or over a whole region or over, you know, a long enough period of time, then it contributes to a style being a certain way.
Right. And given that, any boundaries that we can draw between styles is going to be at least partly arbitrary, how can we draw those in a way that's useful?
So I think keeping in mind that, it's like a river, that there is going to be mixture, and that we're not drawing lines between styles to put up walls. I think that distinguishing from one style to the next helps us kind of appreciate the style on their own terms. So there's two kind of things that I guess I want to say in response to that. So as far as like how we distinguish one style from another, I want to kind of bring it back to the language metaphor. And so like if each style is a dialect of a language, every dancer is still going to have their own voice. And you know, I've heard some dancers say like, okay, well, it's all belly dance and there's not really other styles. There's just, it's belly dance and each individual dancer has her own personal style. And I think that that can be correct and wrong at the same time. And just go with me. It's correct that like we're all speaking the same language of belly dance, and that we all have our own voices. Like on this call, people can pretty easily tell the difference between you and me. We have very different voices, but we're both still speaking with kind of a Northeastern dialect. So I think when you compare a lot of different dancers, if you're thinking about science, you need to have a big sample size before you can draw any conclusions. Not that this is scientific, but for example, Samia Gamal and Taheya Carioca, they obviously dance very differently from each other, but they both dance more similarly to each other than either of them dances compared to, for example, Sule Caraca. And so in order to kind of draw boundaries between styles, it has to be kind of on a zoomed out level. And recognizing that, you know, each dancer is going to have her own voice within that dialect. And whereas I generally, like my dialect, I sound like I'm from Central New York because I am. But every once in a while, I will also say something that makes me sound Canadian because I spent a lot of time there. Or I'll say y'all, which I don't know where that came from. Or
second person really plural. Silent.
Huh?
Go second person plural.
Exactly. English no tienen ustedes. So my dialect, it has like little bits of other places in it too. And so your dance dialect can have other things in it. It's not meant to be walls. So like the other point about this is, some dancers, not everybody who says this, but I've heard certain people say, it's all belly dance. We shouldn't distinguish between different styles. We shouldn't put up these walls. And then like 10 minutes later say, oh, those dancers from that other style are doing it wrong because they're not doing it the way I do. And that is what I think is useful and how we can draw these lines in a useful way about distinguishing different styles. Because, like I said, it lets you appreciate that style on its own terms. Vintage Turkish is not a hyper version of vintage Egyptian. It's its own thing. Vintage Egyptian is not a lazy version of modern Egyptian. It's its own thing. And if I can ramble a little bit.
Go for it. That's when we get to the good stuff.
Thank you. I've been watching a lot of British gardening shows lately and like home renovation shows. And one thing that happens is in American English, when we say the first floor, we mean the ground floor. So you're walking off the street, you're on the first floor and the ground floor are the same thing. In England, the first floor is you walking off the street and then go up one flight of stairs. So we call the second floor, they call the first floor, and what we call the first floor, they call the ground floor. And so imagine that, like, you and a British coworker both get a memo to go to a meeting on the first floor. And you walk into the office and you start walking along, and your British coworker says, "Hey, where are you going? The stairs are over here. The meeting's on the first floor." Who's right? Well, it depends on the context. So it's the same thing with belly dance styles. If the canoon is playing, and you have a vintage Egyptian, like golden era Samia, Gamal era dancer, and you have a modern Egyptian dancer, most of the time, canoon is going to make you want to shimmy these days. They didn't always used to interpret it that way. A lot of times when you're watching like really vintage clips from the black and white era, they'll be kind of more tracing the rises and falls of a tocsin or of the melody line with circles and figure eights and things like this. So you can imagine, you know, a modern Egyptian dancer saying to the vintage dancer, "What are you doing? The stairs are over here. The meeting's on the first floor. What are you doing? The canoe is playing. We need to be shimmying right now." Neither is wrong. They're both right for their own context. Does that answer that question?
It does, sure. And what other benefits do we get by understanding different styles?
Oh, this is a long list.
Go for it.
So kind of in addition to like kind of honoring their aesthetic, it's fun. Like we start belly dancing because it's fun. So I kind of think of it like trying desserts, except that you can't be allergic to a belly dance style. Like you can be allergic to something in a dessert. So try it and see. You might not like it, but at least you tried it and now you know. And if you never try it, then you might not ever realize that that's something that you would really like. I had apple gaudet for the first time in a couple of years ago, and as I was biting into it, my face just like dropped, and I was like, "Where has this been my whole life?" And if I had been set in my ways when I first started and said, "No, I only want to do tribal style, that's all I care about," then I never would have found Egyptian style or Turkish style or any of the, how much I love doing Egyptian style. So that's one reason. Another one is it helps make sense of things. So if you don't kind of distinguish one thing from the other, then it can start getting really muddy and really confusing. And like if you don't distinguish anything, then you might end up like dancing with a Malaya to a Debki song or something like that, you know? Like it helps make things make sense instead of just being like, "Well, all of this is Egyptian, so you're gonna just throw it all in even though you don't know, even though you're mixing things that don't really go together or don't fit the music." It helps things make sense. Also, like, if you might find that you really like one teacher more than another. And that might be down to their teaching style, but also might be down to the dance style that they're teaching. And so knowing what styles you've tried before, which ones you really enjoyed, and knowing that there are differences and that you can, it helps you kind of know when you're looking at classes and workshop descriptions, what do you want to invest your time in?
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, it helps you kind of understand a bigger variety of styles. You know, so that when you're watching something, you know, you're not like confused, like, "Why on earth would she do that? That just seems wrong to me." Well, no, it might make sense within that dancer's context. And if you know more about that style, then you can appreciate it more. Even if you don't end up liking it, you can still at least appreciate it. No one's saying that you have to like everything, but liking and appreciating are two different things. So you can at least appreciate it on its own terms. Yeah, and so it also, like, it gives you a bigger range of expression. You're more able to know, like, what is going to be appropriate for one venue or another. Like the example with, you know, are you dancing at an Egyptian wedding or an American 60th birthday party or at a cultural festival or things like that. There's like with that. I'm going to use the language metaphor again. In Spanish, the word dame means give me. And in Japanese, the word dame means stop it, that's bad, don't do that, no. And so you can see how it's really important to know which language somebody is saying when they say that word. And so it's the same thing with belly dance. What belly dance is means something different to different people. So especially if you're a gigging dancer, being able to get a sense of what do they mean when they say belly dance? Do they mean finger symbols? Do they mean, a big flowing skirt? Do they mean, candelabra and you're going to lead the bride around the room? Do they mean you're going to dance to some Arab classics and then lead the party goers, the festival goers in a Debki line? Knowing what do they mean when they say belly dance, what does it mean to them is really important. And it also, it helps us kind of avoid a shifting baseline. So it's really easy to kind of like to let the styles blend into each other and to not be aware of kind of your own biases when you're watching something. So years ago, another dancer and I were both watching, we're having a DVD night. And I had brought some clips. I brought my DVDs from By Dancers for Dancers. And we picked a few of the performances that were on those. And I think we also watched the performance that was on Ruby Bay's Flawless Floorwork. Or no, it was her Totally Turkish DVD. And so we watched those, and my friend that I was watching with said, okay, well, we've watched a lot of Egyptian dancers, now let's watch some Turkish. And I was like, wait, what? We didn't see it. We saw like maybe one Egyptian dancer, but none of the rest of those were Egyptian. They were all like modern American. And then there was an Ankev dancer, and there was that same Ankev dancer doing Turkish, doing modern Turkish. But to my friend who I was watching with, because her kind of like her lens that she viewed things through was based on kind of an AMCAB style, she could recognize very easily the difference between a modern Turkish and the vintage Turkish that she was used to. So she didn't have as fine an eye for recognizing like modern Egyptian and vintage Egyptian and modern American versus modern Egyptian. Whereas to me, that was really obvious. And I, at the time, could not distinguish between the vintage Turkish and the modern Turkish. It looked the same to me. And since then, I've watched a lot more, and now I can tell the difference. And now she sees the difference in the different like modern American and Egyptian. But it's a little bit like if you live somewhere where there's a big shift in the seasons, like 60 degrees Fahrenheit in the springtime, I'm putting on a tank top and like maybe even shorts or a skirt. 60 degrees Fahrenheit in the fall, I'm putting on a flannel and like wool socks, you know? Because in the springtime, you're used to being really hot. The 60 degrees feels cold. In the fall, you're used to it. In the springtime, 60 degrees feels really warm because you're used to it being really cold in the winter. In the fall, 60 degrees feels cold because you're used to being hot all summer. So if you're used to only watching one style, and you don't ever get other styles from their own perspective, if you're only watching other styles as they compare to the one that you're used to, then it's going to be really hard to see them on their own terms and to see the different kind of shades between them. Like I couldn't see the difference between the different eras of Turkish yet.
All right. Well, let's move on to the main part of our topic, which is getting into, I mean, not to knock that was all really important background, but that's why I ask. We want to get into that. But, you know, with that background in mind, you know, let's move on to what the topic you actually proposed, which was getting into this idea of cross-training under the Middle Eastern dance umbrella. But before we get into that, can you tell us what cross-training is?
So cross-training is just kind of taking classes and studying with a style that's not your kind of home-based style. Not home style like, you know, dancing at your cousin's wedding kind of home style, but like the one that's the main one you focus on.
And why do we get so many recommendations to cross-train in general?
I think, you know, people are trying to be helpful. And so if something works for them, then they're going to recommend it to somebody. And I think that a lot of dancers have come in with backgrounds in different things. And so they recognize how whatever else they've done in the past has been helpful to them. And they want to be helpful to other people who are struggling with things that they've figured out.
Now, the first time that I remember hearing the phrase cross-training was actually in a sports context, and I remember it as advice for athletes in one sport to do other kinds of physical activity that use different muscles to compensate for some of the limitations of their own sport.
Yeah, it also helps you balance out. So, it kind of depends on your technique, I think, a little bit. Some belly dance technique, depending on how you do it, it can be kind of self-balancing, depending on, like, how your posture is and, how you pay attention to keeping, the sides that you practice on balanced and all of those things. I usually tell people, like, if you are belly dancing as your main form of fitness, then you need to be extra sure to practice things on the same on both sides and stretch and be sure your posture is good so that your muscles stay balanced. Luckily turnout isn't part of our dance, so you're less at risk of developing a, inside outside of your leg kind of muscle imbalance. And a lot of the things we do will sort of help you counteract the sort of muscle imbalance that you get from sitting a lot. Like if you're doing hip circles, what I consider the right way, then you're stretching your lower back and you're engaging your abs. Which is the opposite of what happens when you're sitting all day. Your posture is good, and you're using your arms the right way, then you're strengthening your back and you're stretching your chest a little bit, which is the opposite of what happens when you're on the computer and driving the car all day. So it balances those things out. But if you are doing something else as your main form of fitness, to kind of keep you in shape above and beyond your dancing, which, like, if you're a performer, is really important because you need to be in better shape than your dance performance demands of you, so that you can make it through a whole dance performance without, you know, letting the audience see how exhausting it is, or losing your technique, and because that can lead to injury. But if you have something else that is your main fitness form, then that also lets you practice your weaker side more. Like, we all have one direction that's easier. We all have one hip that wants to behave. We all have one leg that shimmies better. And if you're doing something else that's your main fitness form, that's doing the majority of the work to keep your muscles balanced, then you can train a little longer on that side that is not as coordinated, not as naturally coordinated.
So, you know, given that the origin of the term cross training is coming out of this more physically oriented thing, it sounds like a lot of your recommendation is really more about artistic cross training.
It is. I really strongly feel that you can learn everything you need to become a good belly dancer from within a belly dance context. And I think that cross training is a really excellent way to get new insight if something isn't connecting for you, and to get new inspiration when you need to. So let's use arms, for example. Arms is like one of the ones that everybody's always like, how do I fix my arms? And then everybody else always comes back and says, fix that leg. And that's where I go, no, don't do that. You're just making more work for yourself. No cross training is ever going to be a quick fix. It's never a shortcut. There are no shortcuts. I think people have kind of an idea that, oh, I could do 1,000 hours of practicing my arms and belly dance, or I could do 100 hours of pas de bourrées and I'll get the same result. And that's not what's going to happen. You're going to have to do 1,000 hours of practicing pas de bourrées, and then another 1,000 hours.
Did you mean port de bras, maybe?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Thank you. Port de bras. Pas de bourrées is that step that we do when we switch from, like, if you're doing hip drops on one side and you switch to doing them on the other, usually it's a pas de bourrées that is usually used as a transition there. Sorry, port de bras. Thank you. French is not a language that I speak. So you can do 1,000 hours of port de bras, and then another 10,000 hours of taking that ballet port de bras and turning it into a belly dance thing and belly dance sizing it. So you're actually making more work for yourself if you do it that way. But if what you do when you cross train is you use it to get new insight into something that you're stuck on, then that is very useful. And I recommend doing it within a Middle Eastern dance context, because when we talk about, you know, kind of those streams of different styles and history, you're more likely to find something that has, like, crossed streams with belly dance at some point. So there's going to be less work to belly dance size it, to make it into something that fits in your belly dance style. And you're going to have less kind of, not contradictory, but less foreign values that you need to sift through, if that makes sense. Like, I'm going to use ballet as an example over and over again. I am not knocking ballet when I do this. It's just one that is very commonly recommended as a cross train. And I think if you are interested in ballet and learning ballet for its own reasons, then absolutely go cross train in it. But if your only goal is to improve your belly dance, then there are more direct ways to do it. So in ballet, there's kind of a value of the same every time, of precision. I don't remember who it was, but one of your guests talked about kind of the difference between a bouquet of roses versus a bouquet of wildflowers.
That was just me.
Oh, good. Good. Yes. So, you know, ballet is a bouquet of roses, and ballet dance, we want it to be different every time, as Alia Sabat has said. And, you know, we want to have the wildflower bouquet instead. So the so that's kind of an extra value that you're going to have to say, okay, well, I've learned my ballet arms, and now what do I need to change about this to make it belly dance? That's like a level that is not going to be explicitly talked about in either lesson or in either kind of class context most of the time. But that's something that you're going to need to change in order to belly dance size it. It's a really weird word to say, belly dance size. Does that make sense?
It does. So, you know, I largely agree with you on that. I think that there are some things where, for example, the ballet culture has cultivated very specific ways of teaching certain skills, like pointing your toes and extending your legs, that don't necessarily get emphasized in belly dance education in general, which is not to say that they can't be. It's just that we tend not to because we have other priorities. And learning those in the ballet context where they would spend 20 minutes on pointing your toes, I think is helpful sometimes. But at the same time, you know, there are certain things that come along with a ballet thing that you have to unlearn. For example, you know, I found that most dancers, whether they're my students or other people that I've even taken workshops with who have extensive ballet training, they do their turns in a way that only works in low friction situations, like wearing ballet slippers specifically. And that doesn't at all work if you dance barefoot.
And so you can cross train and like get new insight into like, why am I having a hard time with arms, by practicing things within a belly dance or within a Middle Eastern context, so that you're within that same kind of, you know, cross train, cross pollination context, and you don't have to worry about unlearning as many things. In the specific arms context, like, I would recommend Persian dance if you're trying to get the very flowy and graceful. But honestly, a lot of dancers, the main thing is putting more strength into their arms. And so I'm going to go the complete opposite end. And in that specific instance, I usually recommend they cross-train with Romani-style dance. Because at least the way it was taught to me is, you know, you're kind of holding your space with your arms, and that helps give you that kind of frame and strength in your arms. But you mentioned, like, the different ways it's taught, and that is a huge thing, that just the pedagogical methods are very different in the way we teach belly dance and the way belly dance traditionally has been taught, and the way a lot of Western dance is taught. And because most of us are coming at this from as adults, as opposed to, you know, growing up in an Alalim family, for example, where, you know, your mom is moving your hips to the beat before you can stand. We need a certain amount of structure added in just because we're coming at this as adults and we have a lot of catching up to do. But I think that it misses a huge benefit of learning dance from another culture to try and completely change it into a very Western pedagogical method. And obviously different people have different learning styles, so different things are going to connect for different dancers. But the same way, like we, toning your core and improving your posture are benefits of belly dance. And opening up your mind to a different way of learning, and through that, a different way of relating to yourself and relating to the music, and a different way of even relating to time and your to-do list. Those are also benefits of learning to belly dance. And if we force it into a Western context just because it's what we're familiar with, and the familiarity is what's giving us comfort, then we're missing out on a huge potential benefit of it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, you know, let's say that you've decided that you want to do some cross training in another style under the Middle Eastern dance genre. How do you go about that? How do you make choices that will get you the most benefit?
Yep. So, I recommend like everybody take like a certain percentage of your kind of education budget, money or time wise, and allocate it to cross training. For me, that was like one weekend intensive a year. It depends on what your goals are, and it depends on how often you dance, and what your kind of budget for that is. I do like one or two I would do in a different style, and then the rest of them I would do in kind of my home base style. I think how to go about it, you need to sample first so that you know what you're getting. So that you have an idea. And the sampling could be, at first, could be just watching a lot of different things on YouTube. And just kind of getting an idea of what it is about that style. And hopefully, and I know this probably isn't the case everywhere, but hopefully you have a teacher who is familiar with a wide range of different styles and can give you advice. I think that's something I forgot to mention. Like, if you're a teacher, you should have... I don't want to say be a jack of all trades, but, be a jack at the level of all trades and then a master of one, if that makes sense. So you have like a firm base that you have your mastery on for the context of it. Both to situate kind of your home base style in the wider context of the Middle East and North Africa and Turkey. And also to have that for your students, so that when your students come and ask you, like, hey, I want to try something else, I'm curious about, what else there is, then you have an answer for them. And so hopefully if you're trying to cross train, you have a teacher that you can ask that, of.
And when in your dance education is a good time to start cross training?
That much I would say right away, provided the sooner the better, provided the workshops or the other classes that you're sampling are at a suitable level for you. And also recognize, like, if you're an advanced dancer, in your kind of home-based style doesn't mean that you should be taking an advanced class in another style, depending on how similar or how different they are. You want to go down a level or two. Like right now I'm taking, I've been kind of dabbling in Tahitian, not specifically to learn, but just because I think it's fun. And I'm very much taking the most beginner level I can find. If I were to go and take Turkish Oriental, then I might go down to like beginning intermediate, whereas like I'm usually taking more advanced Egyptian style classes. If I were to go take a modern Egyptian class, I would go down to beginner because that stuff is fast. I am just not that fast. If I were going to take Rada, I would go down to very beginner because my feet are not super my feet are not as coordinated as my hips are. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. All right, and how do you decide? Sorry, go ahead.
Does it answer the question?
It does, yeah. So, okay, you know, good. And how do you decide what other related styles would be best to focus on?
So I think this goes back to hopefully you have a teacher that can give you good advice. And doing that sampling at the beginning as soon as you're able to. In order to, you know, just establish kind of a base of knowledge. And the knowledge thing, that's another benefit of it, is you can start making connections in between things that you wouldn't necessarily make if you only focused on one thing, like as far as history and context and all of that stuff. I'm sorry. I got myself on a tangent.
No problem. So, you know, let's say you said, okay, well, I should be cross-training. How do you decide what to cross-train in?
So you need to put in kind of the research to get a base about what different styles are about. And from there, also just consider your goals. Really. Are your goals to improve your arms? Are your goals to improve your footwork? Maybe you want to do modern Egyptian or Rada style to improve your footwork. Or are your goals to get smoother and more snaky? Maybe you want to take some tribal fusion classes. Are your goals to kind of surrender control a little more, but you're not really ready to let the music do it for you? Maybe you want to take an ATS style class where you're getting more comfortable with following the leader. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. And then
it can really depend specific, like what your individual goals are.
Mm-hmm.
And just keeping in mind that whatever you cross-train in, it should also, this is actually probably the most important thing, is it should be something you're interested in for its own sake. Because if your goal is only to improve your belly dancing in your home style, then you might as well just drill in your home style.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're at a point where you're drilling and it's just not clicking and it's not a matter of your brain gets it and your body won't listen to your brain yet, and you need another way in, that's when cross-training is really helpful and can kind of save the day.
Mm-hmm. So two other examples that I can think of are if you want to deepen your understanding of your preferred style, then studying the folkloric dances mm-hmm. that have fed that can give you more context about that style. Or conversely, mm-hmm. if you want to get a better sense of how your preferred style fits into the larger landscape, then picking a different regional style.
I touched on it a little bit, but I thank you for making it more explicit. Like if I never studied anything about Turkish, then I would probably still be kind of blind about the Ottoman Empire's influence on Egyptian styles, which is what I usually focus on. I'm really glad that I had a teacher that was very AMCAD and like introduced us to a little bit of everything because of that.
A really kind of enlightening moment that I had is, I was raised very much in an ABCAB background with a lot of resources in other styles. And when I had been dancing for maybe 9 years, I think, I took a workshop with Artemis and Yasmin called Vive la Difference, where Artemis, she they're comparing Turkish and Egyptian style, specifically like more classical on either end. And they did a lot of things side by side. So they executed the same movements side by side. They played finger symbols differently. We talked about musical differences. And it was very enlightening about those two styles, but nothing made me understand how AMCAB fit into the puzzle, like watching those two things. It was not what they were teaching, but it was like, oh, that's where this comes from.
And especially with AMCAB being such a kind of melting pot of all the different immigrant groups that came over. I'm working on a project that I'm calling The Sands of Time, because who doesn't love a kitschy name? And it's going to be a show at the beginning of September of 2019, where we're going to go through all of these different belly dance styles. The beginning of June, excuse me, we performed a number that was kind of a version of what a finale is going to be, where each verse added a different style, and so the dancers from the previous verse kind of joined the chorus line as the next dancers came on, and then we got up to modern Egyptian, and we all did the last verse together. So we had 40s, 50s Egyptian, 70s, 80s Egyptian, Lebanese, like Nadia Gamal-esque. We had AMCAB and modern American were kind of represented by the same dancer at different times. We had vintage and modern Turkish represented by the same dancer at different times, which it won't be in the full show, but for this performance. And then we had modern Egyptian. And so we're all doing the same number. And it might look like we're out of sync, but we're all purposely doing it in our own style all at once. And it was a lot of fun. I've also been editing what's going to be the actual finale, and maybe I shouldn't give this away, but it's Aziza. And I found different versions of Aziza in all of these different styles. And it's amazing how different that song sounds throughout the ages and from musicians from all these different countries, and it's so much fun.
Awesome. Getting back to this idea of, you've decided you want to cross train. How do you go about it? How much do you need to study in any given cross training genre to get useful benefits out of it?
Well, that definitely depends on your goals. So if your goal is to just kind of unlock some insight into your home style, then you probably don't need much. It just that's going to kind of depend on if you connect with the right teacher partially, but also kind of enough to give you that lightning bolt. That could be, a workshop or a weekend, or it could be, you spend a year taking an extra class each week. It's going to depend on your goals. If your goal is that the only belly dancer in your area and you want to be able to offer anything and respond and be a good fit for any gig that could come your way, then you're going to need to put in a lot more time and effort into that. Then you're going to need to almost be like a Western Conservatory dancer would train in ballet and tap and jazz and modern and lots of different Western dance forms. And if your goal is to be the go-to for any kind of belly dance, then you're going to really need to train in all of those as if each one were your home style. Depending, you know, it just is going to depend on your goals and how much mastery you want to have in each one. And on that note, I would say I personally think that it's a good idea to have kind of one home style that is the one you focus on, or one or two. For me, it's vintage and classic Egyptian styles. And then I cross-train in North African and Turkish and AMCAB and Kaulia and, you know, whatever else kind of comes across that I find interesting. I focus on those Egyptian styles, but I definitely cross-train in AMCAB more than any of those others. So for the past couple of years, I've been taking an AMCAB class every week and then a vintage Egyptian class every week that there is one offered. So in that way, I kind of have two home styles. But doing that can help you kind of just focus your energy and focus focus your dialect, as it were. Help you focus your practice so you're not like, you know, getting to practice time going, oh my God, what do I do? There's so many things I need to work on right now. I think it's a good idea to have something to help you focus that so that you don't get overwhelmed. But if you're someone who can juggle a lot of things, then you might not need to focus it down that much. It's really, really going to depend on your goals, your learning style, how much time you have to practice, and a lot of those things. And definitely try to be, when you're setting those goals, be realistic about how much time and money that you have to put into the training, and so that you're setting yourself up for success. Not so that you're holding yourself back, but just so that you're not making yourself frazzled and you don't set yourself up to feel like you're not doing enough. Because we don't want you to feel like you're not doing enough. You are good enough. You're a good person and people like you. So don't set yourself up to try and do too much. I'm sorry, I'm starting to ramble again.
That's cool. Well, it's almost time to move on to our Q&A section. But before we do that, a couple questions. So one, is there anything that you wanted to talk about on this topic that I haven't asked you about?
I don't think so.
All right. And then if people take one thing away from this call to really internalize it, what would you want that thing to be?
Can it be two things?
Okay.
Thank you. I think the two things would be, one is, it's so hard to narrow it down. You know, appreciate styles on their own terms. Something that might look weird or like off or like not be your taste, you don't have to like it all, but you can still appreciate things for how that style means it to be. I think I had another one, but I guess I'd also say, you don't need to do Western dance to be a good belly dancer. And I really want to harp on that because we don't need Western dance to come in and fix belly dance. And you shouldn't feel inadequate as a belly dancer if you don't have like years of ballet training behind you or something like that. And just kind of trying to experience styles on their own terms and opening yourself up to that.
Awesome. And if listeners want to learn more from you, how can they do that?
My website is farhabellydance.com. It's like far away. And I have a DVD called Belly Dance, The Next Step, which I talked about in the last one. It's kind of to help, especially for dancers who are more isolated, but also just anybody who wants to kind of take control and make sure that they're developing kind of a well-rounded foundation in their dance education. And I have the first volume is out. You can get it on my website or on Etsy. And I have shot the second volume, and I'm moving next week. So hopefully after I move, I will have time to edit it and get it out. And then that show that I mentioned is coming up. And we're going to be doing a Kickstarter to make that show happen. And I'm also going to be putting out a casting call for some of the roles are filled, but there's an awful lot of dancers that will need to pay to help kind of make that show a reality, to show all of these different styles and hopefully kind of expose people to the styles that they might not otherwise see and give kind of a tool for showing context of all of these different belly dance styles and where they come from and how they relate to each other.
Awesome. So let's go ahead and open up this up for questions and answers. So if anybody would like to ask Farha a question or share their favorite takeaway, we would love to hear from you. You can press ** to unmute yourself, or if you are on the webcast, if you can see your personal tile, if you hover over that, you should get a little microphone button, or you can use the question box on the right that looks like a little cartoon speech bubble with three little dots in it. We would love to hear from you, so go ahead.
I promise not to bite.
This is the part where we wait for everybody to see if somebody else goes first.
Yeah. You know, when I'm teaching class, I usually say, like, if you're thinking of a question, there's probably somebody else thinking of the same question, too, and they're going to say thank you when you ask.
It's like cockroaches, but the good kind.
Oh, New York City, you don't say that word.
Well, so while we're waiting for folks to do that, I actually want to talk about a Western dance cross training experience that I had recently. And I did it purely because I wanted to do something that was dance for fun that had no bearing on my job, essentially.
Yeah,
and that's like a tap dance class. All right.
Tap dance.
Yep. My sister had done a year of it when I was very tiny, and I used to like slip her shoes on and play around, but I never studied any. And I had to cancel a class for the first time during the low enrollment, and I was like really, really disappointed. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to treat myself. I'm going to, in that time slot, I'm going to go and I'm just going to do something for me. And I signed up for this tap dance class, and I absolutely hated it. Like, the tap dancing was great, but I couldn't stand the teacher and her, like, values for her student. Like, she's very judgmental and didn't like questions, and like the dancing itself was actually kind of fun, but like, you know what, like I accidentally learned so much about how I need to think about how I don't want to teach and, and what can turn students off to learning.
Yeah.
Just from that experience. So like, you know, sometimes you get totally different benefits than you expect from a cross-training experience.
Sometimes you learn what not to do.
Yep. I will also say that
I've had classes
good
that I taught where I learned what not to do. I keep picturing like a tap dance Debkey fusion. That might be fun.
That could work. Yeah. All right. So we'll call this last call for questions. So if you'd like to ask a question, share your own cross-training experience, or any other tips, we would love to hear from you. All right, then I think we will call it a night. Well, thank you, Farha.
Thank you.
And just to let folks know what's going on in the Belly Dance Geek world, we have some exciting news. If you're not on our mailing list, you may not know it, but we actually have a new member of the Belly Dance Geek team. Her name is Heather Wayman. She's one of my longtime clients. She is in Washington State, and we are so excited to have her on the team. So if you check out our sister podcast, More Than Steps, which is at bellydancegeek.com/steps, as well as on iTunes, you can hear some of her brand new content that she's contributing to our company. So, and thank you everybody for coming. This is the end of our call, but the conversation isn't over. We have a private Facebook group just for Clubhouse members. I'll send out an email shortly with an invitation to that group. Be aware that there is an approval delay. We do check out everybody when you request to join to make sure that you're actually a real member of the dance community and not a creeper. So if you ask to join, just be aware that you may have to wait a couple of days before we check you out and approve you. But that goes towards everybody's safety. That email will also include a link to the call recording, a link to Farha's website where you can check out some of her resources, and a link to our feedback survey. So if you have any topics, questions that you'd like us to cover, or any speakers that you'd like to suggest, we would love to hear from you. Our next call is still TBD. The topic is exciting, but we haven't picked a date yet. So keep an eye on your inbox and we'll announce that soon. And the last thing that I want to say is that this is the come on in kind of clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know somebody who would like to join us, you can invite them to do that at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Night. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.